All right. When you're ready, Dave, fire it up.
Okay. Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the Bronco Space Podcast. This is the student-led collegiate podcast that aims to serve as an introduction to the broad field of spacefaring technology in the new age. I am your host, David Beecher, and I am joined by one of the co-leads of our liquid rocket program, Benjamin Narita.
Hello.
Our PR manager, Addison Van Den Burge.
Hello.
A team member from our CubeSat development program, Jane F. Gohel.
Hello.
A control systems engineer from one of our weather balloon launch programs, Aaron Lowe.
Hello.
And the president of Bronco Space, Michael Pham.
Hello.
The topic of our first episode is of no small import. What exactly is a CubeSat? The first line of the Wikipedia article reads, "A CubeSat is a type of miniaturized satellite for space research that is made up of multiples of 10 by 10 by 10 centimeter cubic units." Michael, could you be able to clear that up for us a little bit?
Yeah, so essentially what a CubeSat is what you just described. It is a satellite that is made up of units, and these units come in sets of 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters in a cube. And you can put together these cubes to make bigger satellites. So you can have a one unit, right? You have two units, perhaps three units, six units, which are 2-3 units next to each other, 12 units, which are 2-6 units next to each other, and on and on. And CubeSats have totally revolutionized the way that we can send things to space. Because for the longest time, space has always just been the realm of government agencies, you know, big commercial interests who have a lot of money behind them, primarily because of how expensive it is to get big, heavy satellites to space.
Right.
Yeah. On TV, it might look like the satellites aren't that big, but in reality, oftentimes,
ginormous.
They are huge. Commercial satellites, you're looking at anything from the size of a van to a 18-wheeler. In fact, the Hubble Space Telescope is an absolute behemoth. That's the size of a school bus. And so the advent of CubeSats has enabled satellite missions to sort of ride along as secondary payloads, rather than requiring an entire multi-hundreds of millions of dollars rocket to get a satellite to space. These little CubeSats now, they can just tag along with the bigger satellites. Or nowadays, they even get their own dedicated rideshare launches, where one rocket might take up anywhere from 10 to 20, even 100 CubeSats up in a single launch.
So Michael, if I may interrupt, it's kind of like Uber, except for satellites, right? In the fact that you can take a bunch of satellites can ride one rocket. And because of that, you're not launching just one satellite into space. You're launching many satellites into space. And that brings down the cost, right? Is that correct or no?
I would say we're not quite at the Uber phase yet. I think where we're at with CubeSats is just the bus, like the bus phase.
The bus phase.
It would be like the public transportation of space.
You know, you have city buses, and you know, you are a CubeSat that wants to go to space.
Right.
You queue up at a bus stop and the bus will arrive,
right,
which in this case is a rocket like a Falcon 9 or an Atlas 5. You get on the bus and it takes you where you want to. It takes you not exactly where you want to go, but it takes you in a neighborhood of where you want to go. And you get off with, you get on and off with a variety of other people, or in this case, satellites. There are commercial companies that do want to introduce that Uber mentality, though.
How?
Rather than, you know, getting on a big ride share, which would be a bus in this case, offering a single dedicated launches. So only a couple satellites all pitch in for a smaller rocket, and they get to pick exactly where they want to go and where they want to go from, just like the Uber analogy.
So would you say it's more like an Uber pool then? Like instead of just like Uber, like regular, it's like Uber pool, like where multiple people can ride one vehicle, right? Multiple satellites can ride one vehicle and get into space, right?
Yeah, yeah. The Uber pool analogy.
A reduced cost for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're making the most, you know, the most out of our vehicle, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So it's actually pretty interesting, which is that these CubeSats, they're relatively cheap. depending on how much capability you want in them, they can range anywhere from $10,000 for a basic one unit up to a couple million dollars for a high-performing 3 or 6 unit, which might sound like a lot of money, but in the scheme of things, it's actually a very small amount of money for space travel. When you take into context something like the James Webb Space Telescope, right? Of course, that is a flagship mission, but that costs literal billions of dollars to get off the ground. For their billions of dollars, rather than buying one really big satellite that has no margin for failure, you can buy tens or hundreds or even thousands of these small satellites that, sure, might not be able to match the capability of a regular, you know, old school giant satellite, but they can go good enough. And you have so many of them, you don't worry so much about losing a couple on the way, which allows the cost to come way down. It allows the development time to come way down, and also opens up brand new capabilities that can be realized through satellite constellations.
Ooh.
That might have never been possible before with only single satellites.
I have a question, because that constellation thing, isn't Starlink a constellation of small satellites, or am I confused?
Yeah, I was actually going to bring that up as well. Would like the difference between like Starlink and Iridium be like the difference between old space and new space then?
Absolutely, absolutely. So like what Ben brought up right there actually is the difference between what's known as old space and new space. And so old space is the idea of the big, you know, you spend $100 million on one satellite and it's going to have a very small margin for failure. It's going to take 10 years to develop, but it's going to be perfect when it launches. The idea with new space is we're just going to launch so many satellites, it doesn't matter if 10% of them fail, because rather than losing the one satellite and just being done, you have maybe 90 satellites still to go after you lose your 10%.
Mm.
And so Starlink actually does fall under the classification for small satellite. The small satellite being defined as a satellite weighing less than 150 kilograms.
Just for background, I mean, for anybody that's listening that doesn't know what Starlink is, Starlink's the constellation of small satellites, I guess, by SpaceX that is actually promising internet connectivity all over the world, which is very, very great, I think.
Yeah. And Ben compared it earlier to Iridium. Iridium is a constellation of communication satellites that have been around for decades now. But the Iridium network doesn't offer nearly as much capability as what Starlink is hoping to offer. In that Iridium is primarily just, you know, satellite phone services. You can't really do any web browsing or anything like that. Whereas Starlink, you know, Elon Musk is hoping to offer gigabit internet anywhere on the globe through Starlink, which is a huge, huge increase in capability.
Yeah. No, imagine like going fishing and then you're fishing and you can like text your mom, hey, look at this fish I caught, you know, like post it on like Snapchat or whatever. That'd be kind of interesting, you know, and you get fast internet on the ocean. I've never been able to do that before.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
Yeah. And that is an example of what is capable with this new class of small satellites.
So from what you're describing, especially from the cheap aspect of it, it's very analogous to the switch to both individual and open source software development that's taken place over the past few decades in the computer industry.
I think would liken it a little more perhaps to the advent of the personal computer rather than from a software perspective. Sort of a transition, right? If you go back to say the 60s or even the 70s, many computers were very specialized tools that cost huge amounts of money to acquire and maintain.
Hmm.
And then you saw this shift towards personal computing,
right,
to where everyone could have a computer in their home. And of course, you know, your personal computer has nowhere near the capability of a supercomputer the likes of a research institute like MIT might have. But the fact that there are so many more of them opens the door for a whole new field of productivity to emerge.
Yeah.
I still remember the first personal computer we ever bought cost $3,000, and that was back in 2000. And I bought a Chromebook last year for close to $300.
Yeah, things have come down in price. I mean, we've been being pushed towards this digital frontier. I mean, I know this is not what we're supposed to be talking about, but wow, we are heavily reliant on computers these days.
And does the low risk nature of it factor into the reduction in cost? As that, if you lose a CubeSat because it didn't cost that much, you're willing to take bigger risks.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's definitely the case that this revolution in small satellites has been fueled by how cheap miniature computers have become. This certainly wouldn't have ever been possible in the early days of the space industry, say the Apollo era, where today, you know, the iPhone that I have sitting here on the desk is perhaps hundreds of times, if not thousands or even millions of times more powerful than the best flight computers that could be fitted on satellites back in the 60s. It's only with this new technology that we're able to have this vast miniaturization in the space industry.
Okay, and our next topic is the history of a CubeSat. So, Michael, our sister school, Cal Polytechnic over in San Luis Obispo, they were instrumental in the development of the first CubeSat and a lot of the CubeSat standards. Would you be able to go more into that?
Of course. So, our sister school, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, in 1999, a professor over at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo partnered with a professors from Moorhead State University, Robert Twiggs. And they together developed the standard for what was known at the time as the Orbiting Picosat Automatic Launcher. And what this was a concept for a 23 kilogram microsatellite that was developed by students at Stanford University and the Aerospace Corporation, El Segundo, California, that would demonstrate the possibility of this new class of picosatellites, ranging from 0.1 kilograms to 1 kilogram in weight, opening up the door to space research for universities. Previously, very few, if any, universities were able to do any sort of real on-orbit research, primarily due to how prohibitively expensive it was to get to space. The idea with OPAL, though, the Orbiting Picosat Automatic Launcher, was that this one microsatellite could ride along with the bigger launch and deploy a small fleet of these picosatellites that can do novel on-orbit research and also provide in a unique learning experience for the students involved, being able to work on an actual space mission while they're still going to the university classes.
And I'm seeing that a lot of CubeSats now are developed by smaller universities. Like I'm seeing, I don't want to call any university small, actually, but the University of Leicester, the QuickSat was developed by Stanford. That might not be a great example of a small university. Mm-hmm. I'm also seeing missions by Kagoshima University in Japan and the University of Michigan.
Yes, so it was in 2003 that the first two CubeSats ever actually made it to space. The OPAL mission was a general success. And after that, teams from Stanford, and in particular the university in Tokyo, the Tokyo Institute of Technology, took great interest in this concept of the Pico satellite as a tool for university-level research and breaking into the space industry for universities. And so what you saw was that after the first couple missions, proving that CubeSats could actually be used to do real research on orbit, it became something that suddenly overnight, but over the course of a decade, enabled all kinds of universities that never could have dreamed of touching space to put together their own missions and actually get to space and do real research. And so you see universities like the University of Toronto or, mm-hmm. you know, our very own Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, other universities, perhaps like University of North Dakota, state schools that are certainly not tier one research universities, being able to launch real space missions thanks to the standard.
Michael, I do have a question. I don't mean to interrupt, but I do have a question is, you know, like you mentioned that these universities can do research now because of these small sats. It's kind of empowering them and bringing down the price floor of getting into space. And I really want to, I really have a question as to like, what kind of research has, or what's probably, I guess, your favorite research? I don't know if we're going to talk about this later on, but I really want to know, like, what have we been able to know more? What kind of research have we been doing on these small sats that's actually really significant or worth a mention?
So my personal favorite CubeSat form factor research mission that I think is a great example of how big science can come in small packages, mm-hmm. is the UCLA ELFIN mission. Now, ELFIN is the Electron Losses and Fields Investigation from the University of California, Los Angeles. And what this mission was a many, many year effort by the geology department at UCLA. And what was it going to measure? Well, it carried two instruments. It carried an energetic particle detector, which investigated essentially high energy particles in the upper atmosphere, and a fluxgate magnetometer, which measures magnetic fields. Now, what the ELFIN mission did is opened the door to this field of high energy physics in low Earth orbit. I should backtrack. So the ELFIN mission was successfully launched in 2018 after a many-year effort by over 250 undergraduate students at UCLA, backed by approximately $3 million from a variety of funding sources, including the National Science Foundation. What was so interesting about this mission is that it was in the three-unit form factor. So it was 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 30 centimeters. Mm-hmm. And unlike any satellite that came before it, it was investigating high energy particles in the upper atmosphere, but it had a trick up its sleeve, which was that it spun. And this is something that had never before been investigated. Previously, satellites, primarily weather satellites, say from the National Weather Service, carry magnetometers to investigate high energy phenomena in the reaches of low orbit. And the purpose of this is to understand the behavior of Earth's magnetic field and how it protects us from dangerous space radiation, whether it is solar radiation or interstellar radiation. Previously, weather satellites would only have these kinds of equipment, like energetic particle detectors or fluxgate magnetometers, as secondary payloads. And they would be oftentimes essentially stationary on the satellite. The satellite would, say, have a view of the Earth and then would sort of just fly through these radiation clouds and be able to measure the magnitude of the radiation presence, but they weren't able to tell definitively what the direction of the radiation was because they were measuring from a single point. And so they could tell how much radiation there was, but not necessarily where it was coming from or where the radiation is going.
And that's where the craft's ability to spin comes into play.
Yes. So UCLA ELFIN has a trick up its sleeve in which it spins at 20 RPM, 20 revolutions per minute. And what this enables is for a 360 degree sweep of the environment around it. And by doing this, they're able to not only have a magnitude for these high energy particles, but a direction in which the particles are coming from. And having any spacecraft spin at any rate is never an optimal design choice, as I'm sure Jay would attest to on our design team. You run into issues such as having problems making communication links with the ground. You have to worry about components of the satellite spinning apart from the centripetal forces. And perhaps above all else, a spinning spacecraft is just not that useful for measuring anything else. And so a weather satellite would never spin because it has to maintain a stable view of the Earth in order to observe things like hurricanes or other weather phenomenon. Whereas this UCLA mission, even though it was hilariously expensive by CubeSat standards, like almost $3 million, being able to have a dedicated mission for this investigation enabled it to unlock an entirely new field of particle physics that had never before been explored on orbit.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll come back with our next topic. So the next topic of discussion is the purpose of Mini CubeSat, which we've covered slightly before with ELFIN and its ability to spin and accurately survey parts of the ionosphere. But in general, what purpose does a CubeSat serve?
So there are four main purposes that a CubeSat can serve. The first of which is education. Because of the low cost of CubeSats, they can be built by student organizations. And oftentimes universities will sponsor students to build a CubeSat to get a hands-on experience with building an actual space mission. The next purpose, scientific. doing some sort of scientific investigation like ELFIN. Perhaps it'll be astrophysics, particle physics. Biology is an emerging field for CubeSats as well. The next purpose would be for technology demonstration. Now, what a technology demonstration is let's say you are NASA, JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and you have developed a new type of radiator. Well, you want to put it on your new space probe that's going to Mars, but you obviously want to test it in space before you put it on the probe. Mm-hmm. And so rather than just not being able to know how it's going to behave in space before you launch it, you can launch it on a CubeSat and demonstrate that the technology works as intended in space on a smaller form factor before it is put on the big high-budget mission. And the final use of CubeSats is for commercial purposes, which are communications, remote sensing, and Earth observation. In this space, there are many commercial providers who are perhaps offering services similar to Starlink, where you get internet from space, or you might see companies like Planet Labs, who are offering Earth-observing satellites, where their whole business model is they fit the biggest possible camera they can in the 3U and take pictures of the entire planet every single day, or remote sensing, like Spire, where their satellites have a suite of weather sensing equipment that can be accessed by public or commercial companies in order to do more accurate weather predictions.
Now, earlier you mentioned that there might be some biological uses behind a CubeSat. Would you be able to go into more detail about that?
Of course. So there haven't been very many satellites launched for biological missions. And that primarily comes down to the fact that biological missions are relatively high risk in the aerospace industry. And that's primarily because you have to keep the plants or living creatures that you send into space alive somehow. And that is a very complex, that's a very complex engineering challenge.
Yeah, but like on Chang'e 4, they sent up like a small like biosphere to land on the moon. Would you say some like an experiment like that would be possible in a CubeSat form factor?
It would probably be possible. The issue would come with getting someone to actually launch it. Something that would definitely just have to be a dedicated launch because of how risky it is to launch a pressure vessel on your satellite. Hmm. Why that is a concern? Well, if you need to have a little, you know, tank of air for your, say, plant to survive, well, when you send that to space, it essentially becomes a bomb because of the internal pressure. And so launch providers are generally very hesitant to launch biological missions. But it's not to say that they haven't or they won't. In fact, scheduled for the first, now it's called Artemis. It used to be called EM-1. The first Artemis launch of NASA's Space Launch System to the moon, there's a satellite manifested known as BioSentinel, which is essentially going to be carrying a whole deck of Petri dishes with various species of yeast and other microorganisms to investigate how they respond to interstellar flight. And based on that information, we hope to be able to extrapolate how the human body would respond to interstellar flight.
So these individual organisms are sent up in contained packages with atmospheric conditions that are suitable for them, correct?
Yes, yes. And that is why biological missions are generally very difficult to conduct, because you have to take a tiny piece of Earth with you on your space mission.
So does the form factor of a CubeSat contribute to risk mitigation in those cases?
It generally does. It generally does. The form factor mitigates the risk by allowing for lower cost associated with development and getting on orbit. You look at something like the International Space Station, which is at the moment the only permanent laboratory in space. That is literally the most expensive thing that human beings have ever built. And the risks associated with operating the International Space Station are rather monumental. Having to send up human beings to constantly maintain the space station and ensure that the experiments on board are running properly. It is, of course, a risk that we are willing to take, as can be seen by the fact that the space station has never been unoccupied since its conception. But the smaller form factor of CubeSats could potentially enable missions to test biological payloads outside of just a space station, allowing for a vast array of biological tests to be done on orbit without having to risk the lives of our astronauts on a space station.
So can you give an example of the use of a CubeSat as a communication tool? What intrinsically about a CubeSat would make it better as a communication tool, or as a spacefaring communication tool, rather?
Mm-hmm. So for this, we can look towards a space mission such as Marco. Ben, would you actually take this one? Because I know you do have some background knowledge on Marco.
It's not a huge amount of background knowledge, but what I do know is that there are two Marco satellites, Marco A and Marco B, that were sent along with the InSight lander on Mars to relay communications from the lander back to JPL. They were only active during the beginning of the mission.
Yeah, so Marco was the Mars CubeSat Observer, and there were two of them. And the benefit of the CubeSat form factor in this case was to act as a communications relay. Essentially, these CubeSats were flying radios. That was their entire purpose. They were the largest radio array that could be fit on a 6-unit form factor, and they were sent to accompany the recent Mars lander, InSight. And their purpose was to get information from the surface of Mars back to us here on Earth much, much faster than would be possible with the current infrastructure. Now, why is that? It is really a case of strength in numbers, especially when you're looking at great distances, such as from Earth to Mars. Having more antennas means you have more bandwidth, and you're able to get data to move faster from the surface of Mars back to Earth. And this comes into play here in low Earth orbit as well. Without even necessarily leaving our own backyard, having CubeSats act as communication satellites, it is, again, strength in numbers. You can just have so many satellites that are essentially just flying radios that you're able to provide orders of magnitude more coverage,
more bandwidth.
And by extension, bandwidth, than existing satellite networks.
So the low cost of development is an invaluable asset there.
Yes, yes. Being able to deploy hundreds of satellites to cover the same amount of ground as what one satellite might have cost.
So I have a question.
It's a huge step forward.
I have a question. So just to give me an idea of how much of a difference, do you happen to know what those speed differences are without those Marco satellites versus just the lander, signaling back to Earth versus going through Marco and Marco 2? Like how fast do you know the bit rate, or can you equate that to, you know, what you can send and receive from that craft, or no?
I unfortunately don't know off the top of my head. But what I can say is that there's currently a concept under development between the Aerospace Engineering Department here at Cal Poly Pomona and NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab for a CubeSat that would transit the space between the Earth and Mars as essentially a flying hard drive. The issue right now is that even with the best of technology in our deep space network, we'd be lucky to get megabytes or megabits per second of data downlink from our probes on Mars. Sometimes it is so bad as kilobits per second. Not only that, but it takes a staggering 30 minutes for messages to make their way to Earth from Mars at light speed.
Wow.
And so at the moment, there's a concept in development for a single or perhaps even a fleet of satellites that would transit the interstellar space on regular intervals between Earth and Mars with massive data banks. And what they would do is they would approach Mars, and as they fly by, they're able to quickly upload all of the data that has been saved up by the rovers. And then they fly back to Earth. And then when they fly by Earth, they're able to quickly download all of that data down to the servers here on Earth.
That's an interesting concept.
Now you might ask, well, doesn't it take months to fly between Earth and Mars? And it does. But even on a time scale of months, the fact of the matter is that the strength of a radio transmission is a function of the distance squared. And so even just having the distance, right? Or let's say in this case, you double the distance between us and whatever we're communicating with, you see a 4x decrease in how powerful the radio signal is between the two parties.
And
that comes down to the inverse square law.
That's interesting, because I'm assuming now that because you have this craft that's kind of like messenger, you know, sending these banks of data, you probably have to spend less, or that allows you to spend less on your radio antennas. Is that correct? Or is that just...
It does. It does. Yeah, this is a huge part of it, where right now, a huge amount of power and resources has to go into the radio equipment on the rovers. And you could totally cut that down with this new concept using the CubeSats, where rather than having to beam data all the way from the surface of Mars to the surface of the Earth, now the rovers just have to beam data to the CubeSat flying Mars orbit.
I just thought about this too. And like imagine if you have a finite power supply. I mean, I know the Curiosity rover in March 2020 it's called Percy, right?
Perseverance.
Like they have, I know they have like a MMRTT, like basically a radioactive power supply. But like if you have a rover basically with a finite power supply, you don't have to spend all that power, you know, beaming information to Earth, and you can just like hand it over to a satellite, and all of a sudden that brings down how much, you know, electronics you need to put on the actual science equipment. And that's interesting. So you're kind of offloading all that to something else, you know. That's a really cool concept. I like that.
I'm going to take a quick break before we transition to our next topic. Maybe I can also stand up and stretch. The next topic of discussion will be the development process behind a CubeSat. And we've covered some of this already, with intrinsic factors of a CubeSat being reproducibility and low cost. Michael, would you be able to go into a little bit more about the development process behind a CubeSat?
Of course. So this sort of stems off of what the general development process for anything that the aerospace industry does. And it always has to start with mission definition. You know, why are you doing what you're doing? Mm-hmm. And so in general, the lifetime of a CubeSat's development can be seen on a timescale of approximately 2 years, where we start with defining the mission. And so what is a CubeSat going to do? Is it going to go there? Is it just going to educate people? Is it going to go, is going to observe something? Or is it going to go and demonstrate some technology? And based on that, we can begin the design process. Now, that generally takes a couple months to a year. And then prototypes have to be made in order to test. Does the design actually work? And what improvements can be made? And this is actually one of the great benefits of CubeSats, which is relatively cheap to make multiple iterations of the satellite before you send it to space. It wasn't really a case where we made multiple iterations of the space shuttle, for example, before we decided to launch one. The one that we launched was the one that was going to work. Whereas with the CubeSat, you can make 3, 4, 5 CubeSats and then test them all and then make minor improvements to each iteration and see and directly observe what works, what doesn't. Now, once your CubeSat is designed, built, and then tested through a battery of tests such as vibrations testing, thermal vacuum testing, electronics testing, then it's time to get it to launch. And at this point, there are many options. For most universities, they go through NASA. NASA has what's called the CubeSat Launch Initiative, which allows universities to apply to have their launch costs compensated by NASA. For the furthering of NASA's strategic goals or the education of the next generation of space engineers.
So a college CubeSat program might have their program entirely funded by NASA to develop a CubeSat for their purposes.
Yes, yeah, so NASA has what are called small satellite technology partnerships. And this program is partnered with oftentimes smaller universities, not your tier one research universities, smaller universities like the California State University at Northridge, for example. And these are small universities that don't have a lot of funds for research, but they have great ideas. And NASA invests in them, not only to try to see if those ideas pan out, but also to make these universities into universities that are able to give a hands-on education for exactly what NASA and the greater space industry needs going into the future.
So this program might also be seen as a recruitment tool through NASA.
Of course, of course. And one of the things is also that you also see private companies such as Northrop Grumman or Lockheed Martin, sometimes even Boeing, also funding university research projects in the CubeSat form factor, because they too are interested in seeing the students that work on these projects have real world experience with the same kinds of space mission design that you would expect in the industry. So Jay, do you think you can tell us more about what exactly goes into the aerospace engineering design process?
Yeah, so the aerospace design process relies on a fundamental use of engineering called systems engineering, which is fairly industry specific. And it follows that life cycle that Michael was talking about earlier, which is one where you define the mission, you define the requirements, you develop it, you implement that design, so you actually make the CubeSat, and then you test it and you make sure it's right, and then you launch it, and then you see it live through its launch cycle. So that's sort of the fundamentals of the systems engineering component, which is someone who's going to help oversee that in a much more technical aspect, so that way there are requirements for all the, or there are tests for all the requirements, and that implementation is done in an efficient manner, and that everything works before you send it off to space. Usually in the CubeSat industry, systems engineering isn't as popular because of the rapid rate that CubeSats are manufactured in, but it still is used fundamentally in the way that the design is developed and the final product is developed.
So we often see that there are multiple checkpoints that engineering design has to go through. Is that correct?
Yeah, so oftentimes there are different design reviews, which are done usually with the customer. So let's say if NASA's funding you for a project, then NASA will say, at certain dates, we need you to come in and explain to us where you are in the design process. So that's from a conceptual design to a preliminary design to a critical design to finally an integration test. And then every integration test gets its own review. And then you finally get a full-scale review before you send off to launch. And so those are checkpoints that a customer might look into, but or whoever's funding the project will look into to make sure that the project's on track. And there's also these hard stop deadlines to make sure that you are ready to go.
And now, one of the other things that's a pretty important consideration during the design process is, of course, mission operations. This is something that a lot of new CubeSat developers especially have a problem, or not necessarily a problem, but is oftentimes neglected by new CubeSat developers, which is, what exactly is the CubeSat going to do once it gets to orbit? When is it going to make contact with the ground? Where is it going to make contact with the ground? Because the CubeSat might not at all, or very rarely, fly over your own ground station. And so you need to arrange with other ground stations around the world, or through a commercial service to get your data actually back to you. Other things that go into mission operations, such as the operation of the payload. Like, say, you have an imaging payload, well, you best have a schedule for when and where you're going to take pictures and how they're going to be delivered to the customer. And so even though the cost of doing a space mission might have come down significantly over the last few years, the complexity behind it certainly has not. And that is a big part of why these CubeSats are such a valuable tool for education, because there's just so many things that go into a CubeSat, and these are all things that can be very teachable moments for the students involved.
Okay, and our final topic of today is favorite CubeSat missions and current events. So, I've neglected to mention that Bronco Space has its own Cube satellite mission named Project Monolith. Michael, would you be able to go into more details about Project Monolith?
Of course. So, Monolith was conceived by a joint team of Cal Poly Pomona students and engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And the basic concept behind it, well, the one word summary, the one sentence explain like I'm five summary is that Monolith is a mission to send ice cubes to space. But it is, of course, a little more complicated than that.
You're going to have to give some context behind that.
Yes, of course. So essentially what we're looking at is space is an environment of extremes, extreme hot and extreme cold. Mm-hmm. And you want to do your best to try to mitigate those extremes as much as possible on a spacecraft. And so the concept behind Monolith is to deploy what is called a phase-changing thermal control system.
Like an air conditioner.
What's a phase-changing thermal control system? I have no
so clue. A phase change, great question, Madison. A phase changing thermal control system is essentially ice cubes. Like, that's literally what it is going to be on our satellite. The idea behind it is that you pick a material that has a really high thermal capacity and heat of fusion. You might remember these terms from your chemistry class. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, the basic idea is that these materials, they take a lot of energy. A lot of heat, yes. A lot of heat.
Like a sponge for heat.
Yes. They can absorb a lot of heat before they change phase, either from, say, a frozen state to a liquid state, or rarely a liquid state to a gaseous state. And the idea is that by having, like, solid frozen water on your satellite, when it's exposed to the heat of the sun, the ice will melt. And it will absorb all of the solar heat so that the rest of the satellite maintains a nice, cool temperature. And then once you swing back around and you're outside of the sun, the now water can refreeze and return to a solid state. And when you come back out to the sun, it once again melts and absorbs all of the heat. And this is an example of a technology demonstration mission, mm-hmm. because this is something that has never been tested before. At least on this small of a form, small of a scale.
Hmm. That's interesting because that rhymes with some things in HVAC or air conditioning, where you have, on Earth you have refrigerant. I forget what it's exactly called, but you have it where it has a very low temperature relatively that this substance can turn into a gas. But I guess in space, because you have those extremes. Water might be more suitable for that, and plus it has a bigger thermal capacity, I'm assuming, where it takes more joules of energy to raise that water by 1 degree Celsius. And that's interesting because the way that an air conditioner works is just it evaporates. It's kind of like, you know, like sweat. It evaporates this refrigerant to make it cooler inside your house. So I mean, that's basically like having an air conditioner on your satellite, right?
It is. Huh. It is. And what's so attractive about it is that this is a passive thermal system, in that the idea is that it just freezes and melts on its own, and you don't need any pumps, no moving parts,
heat exchangers,
nothing to worry about.
That's interesting. No points of failure, basically.
Now, you've mentioned that water as a phase-changing material has been hitherto untested in satellites. So how have previous CUBE satellites mitigated the risk of solar conditions, incident radiation, and extreme cold?
Well, larger satellites can afford complex cooling systems, either through radiators and heat pumps or otherwise. In the CubeSat form factor, though, oftentimes it comes down to what we just called a barbecue roll, which is the satellite will have a spin induced on it, so that no one side is ever exposed to the sun too long. Sort of like how a rotisserie chicken will slowly turn in an oven so that one side doesn't become burnt while the other side isn't cooked. This, of course, isn't an optimal solution, especially if you don't have an active control system on your satellite, because then you're just in an uncontrolled tumble. And now, one of the places where we think this technology could be very valuable is actually for lunar applications. And so even though we're going to try to test Monolith in low Earth orbit, the idea would be that eventually this water-based phase change of control system can find its way to the surface of the moon, which has legendarily been an extremely hostile place, mainly because of how long the lunar day and night cycle is. The lunar day can be, well, it is, upwards of 14 days long, and the lunar night is also 14 Earth days. And so throughout this process, you have 14 days where your satellite's just baking in the sun, and 14 days where it's freezing outside of the sun. And what we're proposing is that this phase-changing thermal control system, you can have a very large thermal capacitor that can help dampen the response of the extremes of temperature. It wouldn't totally mm-hmm. eliminate the problems. You would still need radiators or other types of materials.
Right.
But where it really becomes valuable is dampening the response and smoothing it out so that even though you have to still have an active control, an active thermal system, it can be a smaller, lighter, and more simple active thermal system with the use of the water-based phase change and control system.
And you've explained the thermal control system, but that is only one part of the satellite's name, and there are, in fact, two more components to the satellite.
Yes, so there are two more components. This is a very ambitious mission in that along with the phase-changing thermal control system, we're also planning to test a new type of battery, lithium titanate, and we are working with our partners at NASA JPL to introduce additive manufacturing processes to the satellite. So what that means is that we are going to essentially 3D print this satellite from metal using what's called direct metal laser sintering. And the benefit of this is that Well, Ben, do you want to tell us about the benefit of that, actually?
Yes, sure. So with DMLS printing, what you can do is you're using a laser to melt, I guess, metal powder into a shape, and you'll just layer more metal onto it as it goes. And so the advantage of this is we are printing the satellite in a single component, with it being completely hollow and having like some sort of structure on the inside to convey the heat that we have stored up or are trying to dissipate inside of the satellite to all of the components.
Yeah, so it's not just inside, like it's actually going to be embedded in the structure.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. So all of this is embedded inside of the structure of the satellite. So say like our battery warmers. It'll be the batteries inside of their container, which is surrounded by the phase changing material. So that'll keep the batteries at a constant temperature of 0 degrees Celsius, hopefully, which is where lithium titanate batteries are actually very efficient.
Now, Ben, classical batteries are made from lithium phosphate, if I recall correctly. What advantages does a lithium titanate battery hold over that?
So lithium titanate batteries, they can operate at much lower and higher temperatures, and they can charge and discharge faster. I don't exactly know the composition of all of these, or of these batteries. Michael, do you?
Yeah, so essentially, most lithium-ion batteries use carbon as the anode. What's different about lithium titanate is that it uses titanium oxide. And there's some really fancy, you know, nanostructures, material science that goes into it. But essentially, the titanium oxide, instead of carbon as the anode, you increase the actual surface area of the anode by literal orders of magnitude. And this allows for very rapid discharge. But more importantly, it totally eliminates an issue known as metallic lithium plating, which is a phenomenon where at 0 degrees centigrade, lithium ions can actually condense out of the electrode and onto the plate of the anode, rendering the battery totally useless. This is why when you go to, say, the snow with your mobile phone or whatever other lithium ion operating device, it automatically will shut itself down to protect itself from this metallic lithium plating.
Interesting. And I imagine that the wide range of operability temperatures for a lithium titanate battery also plays into the strength of the phase-changing material dampening extreme temperature shifts.
Absolutely. One of the reasons that water is actually viable is because of the wider temperature range of lithium titanate batteries. Whereas when you look at more traditional phase-changing materials like paraffin, they have much higher melting temperatures, and so it's more friendly to normal battery technologies. And you had like a question there?
Gonna say like the old lunar rovers that launched with the Apollo missions would use paraffin simply because their batteries needed to be at those higher temperatures.
At those higher temperatures,
And we're not talking hilariously higher, like 20 to 30 degrees centigrade.
Yeah. Is paraffin that like gold film that I see on some satellites or some?
No, that's actually
paraffin's a type of wax, right?
Yeah, paraffin is a wax.
Oh, right.
And the gold film you see is actually what's known as MLI or multi-layer insulation.
And what does that do? Is it some sort of like thermal protection, or is it like
It is. Huh. Yeah, it's generally thermal protection.
Does it serve as like radiation protection or no?
Not really. Usually MLI is designed to be very not dense, mm-hmm. Lightweight,
right.
And really just shield against thermal radiation, not
yeah.
say alpha or beta particles, gamma radiation.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because it's a film, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Dave, you had a mission that you wanted to discuss as well, didn't you?
Oh, my personal favorite Cube satellite mission was a satellite launch with Stanford University. It's called QuakeSat, which is it's a traditional QuakeSat. It's a traditional CubeSat package sent up, but it had several highly sensitive magnetic instruments in it, which detected slight variations in Earth's magnetic field that would give sort of a precursor warning to earthquake zones. Now, naturally, when a lot of energy is stored in Earth's crust, it tends to compress and condense the rocks in areas such as transform faults. And those rocks can induce new magnetic fields through the piezomagnetic effect, which is very similar to the piezoelectric effect. When you put stress on a crystal or something like sulfur, it'll exhibit electricity. In this case, if you put stress on rocks, that'll exhibit new magnetic fields. And these instruments in the CubeSat sent up by Stanford could detect varying shifts in those magnetic fields and give sort of a slight indication of where an earthquake might be liable to happen in the future.
And it's interesting that you selected QuakeSat, because QuakeSat consequentially is one of the first CubeSats ever launched, wasn't it?
I believe that to be the case, yes.
And so it was an interesting sort of demonstration of this new technology.
That's cool. I mean, I've never heard of anything, I mean, until now, of anything predicting earthquakes. You know, when I was in back in school, like before college, like, you know, they were like always like, yeah, no, you can't predict earthquakes. They just kind of happen. But we're now going into this technology where we can, you know, where we're thinking outside the box and we can actually predict earthquakes or give a...
Thinking inside the cube in this case.
Thinking inside
the cube. There is no finite prediction for earthquakes at the moment. It's right. Still just detecting slight variations in magnetic fields. But mm-hmm. This might give us an indication of where earthquakes might be likely to happen in the future at an undetermined amount of time. There's no right. real way to predict with any accuracy like on the random dot. Tectonic motions.
Even like some statistical probability is more information than none, you know.
Shall we move on to our current events? So I think we will have to preface this section by saying that we are recording on April 4th, 2020, and by the time this podcast comes out, whatever we talk about might be totally irrelevant, or it might sound like we are prophets foreseeing the future. So, Ben, I think you had something you wanted to start us off with.
Well, so I guess the big news in aerospace most recently would be that yesterday, SpaceX's third Starship prototype was destroyed when they filled the... Let's see, I think they filled the liquid methane tank, and they pressurized the liquid oxygen tank, and since the methane tank is above the oxygen tank, when the oxygen tank depressurized, the whole thing crumbled and blew up. or not exactly blew up, but, you know, burst because of pressure.
So, doesn't Mr. Musk want to be making three of these every... No, he wants to be making one of these...
He wants to make one of these
every week by the end of the year.
That's crazy.
Do you think he's actually going to accomplish that?
wait. Prototypes or the actual Starship?
I mean, rapidly iterated prototypes, I guess, that will hopefully be flying. But yeah, so SN3 was actually scheduled to fly sometime this week, which it obviously won't be doing now. But I guess that leaves room for SN4 to...
If you had to put a timeline on it, I guess when would you expect there to actually be a successful flight?
I don't know. It'd probably have to be maybe in like a month and a half to 2 months at least, because I do think SN4 is going to break as well at some point.
Oh, of course.
It's interesting, definitely, though, like how disruptive SpaceX has been, kind of like how disruptive CubeSats have been, but it's just a whole new way of doing aerospace engineering versus traditionally how it's done.
Yeah. Their rapid iteration versus, you know, long planning.
Oh, yeah.
But SpaceX's rapid iteration is very interesting to watch. And it's very cool. It's definitely taking a lot of money. Like, most traditional aerospace programs just can't keep up with that. Like, they just don't have the time or funds to be building that many prototypes that quickly and just breaking them. Like, if you took an SLS prototype, like, the SLS, just to make the tanks for it to test with pressure like this, took them, like, a couple of years just to set up the equipment. Well, SpaceX just has a bunch of people going out there with welding torches and putting this thing together.
Yeah, I think I read about somewhere how SpaceX has this advantage over other companies, especially NASA, in the fact that SpaceX is incredibly vertically integrated. Everything comes from SpaceX, and in contrast to other organizations I guess NASA. You had multiple companies, like even with the STS program, the
space shuttle.
Yeah, the space shuttle. I mean, the SRBs, the solid rocket boosters, were made by one company. The orbiter itself was made by another company. The external tank was made by another company, and it required all these companies to come together and make one thing. And if one lags, and one is waiting on the other to complete something, I mean, the whole project or the whole, you know, the people behind them are gonna wait on that one person or that one company. And yeah, with the incredible amount of vertical integration that SpaceX has, I mean, I think that's what's contributing to their ability to rapidly prototype. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that does help with their rapid prototyping, but just the simplicity of their design too really helps with their ability to rapidly iterate.
Yeah,
like, you know, the Starship just uses people out there with TIG torches, you know, putting big steel rings together. You know, SLS has beautifully machined aluminum tanks that are friction stir welded by enormous machines. Like, you know, if SpaceX were to do it that way, they would not have a Starship prototype for probably another 3 years.
So they have a bunch of these efficiencies, right?
Yeah. I would think it's just a big difference in methodology more than anything.
It's not necessarily an inefficiency, but it's just a much rougher way of doing it. Like, it's like the difference between, I guess, for example, if anyone knows about like tank design or anything, it's like the difference between a T-34, you know, the Russian kind of mess of a machine that just worked, versus like a Tiger II or something that spent, you know, 10 years on the drawing board, eventually came off and didn't quite work as well as they wanted it to.
Yeah. And I think you sacrifice...
That just got over-engineered.
Guaranteed stability. Like, now the Falcon 9s are pretty good, but early on they definitely faced a bunch of challenges. Mm. And when you go in such a rapid fashion, things can get left behind and not everything gets checked as thoroughly as it needs to.
You sacrifice your performance for just being able to make more of them faster.
You know, I don't know. Coming from a, I don't even know if this is relevant, but thinking on lines with interdisciplinary things that, you know, kind of like rhyme with that. It's kind of interesting that idea of rapidly prototyping is kind of like making many and seeing what sticks. Kind of like throwing a bunch of dots. Or darts at a dartboard and seeing what, you know, makes it to the center.
Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of how a lot of things work in, you know, even in biology, even in AI, where you have a bunch of, let's say, a colony of roaches, right? And something happens to that environment. Let's say an exterminator comes and tries to spray all of them. A few are going to survive, right? And that trait that they may have, whether it's like, you know, like staying out of sight or whatever else, those specific or a small population of that colony is going to survive. And that kind of like here's a bunch and let's see what survives is kind of like what's going on in that industry where you're seeing what sticks. And that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's definitely a very different way of thinking. I think if you're new to the aerospace industry, maybe one of the most shocking things is just how risk intolerant the aerospace industry is. There is, well, traditionally at least, there is no margin for failure. Failure is simply not tolerated. Everyone knows the quote that's misattributed to Gene Kranz, the flight director during Apollo 13. Failure is not an option. You see it all the time on people's on people's Facebook timelines with inspirational photos. But it is very true, which is at least traditionally the way aerospace has always operated is that failure isn't an option. Like, I know Ben, you and I both know from the first day of our aerospace lectures as aerospace engineering students, the first thing that we were told is, in this industry, you don't make mistakes because in other industries, when you make mistakes, people just lose money. But in this industry, people die. And it's interesting that now you're seeing this big shift in methodology where companies specifically like SpaceX are like saying, well, you know, why don't we just do more
and learn from our failures?
Yeah, like you walk yourself back from the margins, right? And you go for this rapid iteration approach instead of going for perfection right from the get-go. And it's not really something new, I wouldn't say. It's new to aerospace, which is why the industry is being very shook up right now. But it's not new, really, to any other industry. Software's been doing it forever. Even you look at, say, like the automotive industry, right? Building large amounts of prototypes and then, you know, testing and just going for mass production of what works.
That like goes back to our old space versus new space discussion, where you get to see that in this new space timeline where you get a lot more privatization of the industry and more people with money who are able to play in the game, that you get these different models outside of just DOD and NASA funding that was primarily fueling the operation. So it'll be interesting to see you in the next few years just how the industry moves forward in comparison to how it was operating during the space shuttle era.
And I do think that this the new small sat industry is really going to be what drives this sort of revolution in the space industry, where of course, you know, everyone is excited for Crew Dragon and the return of astronauts to space launching from U.S. soil. But I think that, you know, that's kind of just going to be akin to a crowning achievement rather than really what is driving the innovation in the industry, which is these small satellites. And what's so cool about them is that, you know, with CubeSats, students, like us students, have the opportunity to be on the front lines making that change.
On that note, we're going to end here. I'd like to thank you all for joining us for the first episode of the Bronco Space Podcast, the student-led collegiate podcast that aims to serve as an introduction to the broad field of spacefaring technology in the new space age. So long, and ad astra.